Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Incomparable, number 642, November 2022.
Welcome back, everybody, to The Incomparable. I'm your host, Jason Snell, and in this episode, we're going to talk about one of my favorite movies of all time. It's a perfect Thanksgiving weekend holiday fare, the holiday season. We're going to kick it off right. We're going to put you in the mood. We're going to get you ready. It's 1990s Goodfellas, directed by Martin Scorsese, a film about gangsters. And it is one of my personal favorites. Also, I decided to do this in honor of Ray Liotta, who passed away earlier this year, because this is his movie, and he's great in it. Joining me to talk about Martin Scorsese's excellent Goodfellas are these following wonderful people. Excellent people, in fact. Monty Ashley is here. Hello.
Hi. Another few minutes, I could be a stool.
You can't be a made man because both of your parents aren't Sicilian. Philip Michaels also joins me. Hi, Phil.
They call me Philip two times because that's how many times I'm booked on this podcast. No, I don't know.
Oh, you also cannot be a made man because your parents are not Sicilian.
No.
John Siracusa, can you be a made man?
I think they just said that they had to be able to trace both your parents back
to the old country. Yeah.
Which means Italy, in which case, yes, I can be a made man.
Well, I would recommend you not fly off the handle and kill Billy Bats then.
Yeah, that would really mess up that deal.
You don't want to do that. I don't even know. Like, oftentimes I will walk through a movie and we could do that. There's so many great scenes in here, or we could just talk about like all the elements to this thing. Because I'm going to start with my traditional thing, which is tell me about your personal relationship to the movie, just to get us warmed up here. I saw it in college and loved it, and I have the poster, and I got the soundtrack, and I think about why I liked it so much, and in watching it again for the first time in a few years, I have some theories about that I'll save to later, but I have loved this movie since it came out, and that's my whole history with it. Monty, what about you?
I also saw it in college. I also loved it. I had the DVD, which was a very early DVD.
It was a flipper, wasn't it?
Yeah. You had to flip it over in the middle of the movie.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember when in the movie you had to flip it?
No.
I don't either. I also had the flipper, and I don't remember it either. And I keep expecting it'll be like that tape that I had, that mixtape that I had where the last song runs out in the middle. And every time I hear that song, I get to that moment and I'm surprised that the song continues. But I don't have that with Goodfellas. So it must have been a perfectly reasonable moment for the flipper to flip.
Yeah, I remember it being annoying. Yes. But I always did get up and watch the second half of the movie.
Wouldn't it have been hilarious if it was the moment where they killed Joe Pesci? Oh, no! Please flip the DVD!
Yeah, over to the other side. Phil, you went to the same college as me and Monty. Is your story similar?
Yes. You know what, Jason? I saw it in college when it came out. I saw it the opening weekend it came out. There was no... I fancied myself a bit of a Martin Scorsese fan at the time, and I continue to be. And so Martin Scorsese has a gangster movie coming out. Let me knock people out of the way on my way to that terrible movie theater at the bad shopping center.
The one on La Jolla Village Drive, yeah.
Yeah, the La Jolla Village Drive, I think, is where I saw it.
That's what we're here to talk about today, is that shopping center.
No, no. Actually,
Osco,
it was at
Save-On? Oh, was it at UTC?
At UTC because
totally
I was new in town on camp, and I went... And I went the wrong direction coming back home and ended up in Miramar.
I'm gonna turn off that segment that I was prepared to do where I reminisced about various shops at the shopping center next to UC San Diego. We're not gonna do that today.
Okay.
John Syracuse.
Are we gonna reminisce about UTC instead? It had a nice rink.
It did. John Syracuse, how about you? What's your relationship with this movie?
I'm the youngster in this podcast. I saw it when it came out and I was in high school, not college. Yeah, because I hadn't yet graduated in a couple of years. I think when I saw it, by the time I saw it, I had seen like Mean Streets, Taxi Driver, and Raging Bull as kind of like more my Scorsese repertoire or whatever. So I was inclined to like him, but I'd also obviously seen the Godfather films and I really love those. And this, you know, advertises as a gangster movie and Martin Scorsese. It's like, you've got my attention, sure. But I'm like, well, it's not going to be as good as the Godfather movies. Like, I mean, how could it be? Let's not have your expectations get up too big. And I think when I saw this, I think this is the viewing of this in the theater is probably, I mean, it helps that I was in high school, but the most impressed I will ever be probably with how good somebody is at making movies. Mm. You watch it, you're like, wow, this guy is really good in making movies, which is kind of a thing a child would think because you get older and cynical and you've seen it all. But also watching it again and watching it all these years later, I had it on VHS, I had it on DVD, I've got it on Blu-ray. This guy's really good at making movies.
He really is. To me, he was the director of After Hours and The Last Temptation of Christ, of course.
Ah, yes.
Actually true. Actually, true.
As all high school students know him.
And
as
Mean Streets. Those are the three Scorsese movies I think I had seen when I saw this. Yeah, he's really good. In fact, I was thinking, I don't know why I have this impression of Martin Scorsese, because I know better. But like, I always felt artistically, it was like he was like an artistic film director, and he, like, the kind of guy who would be like, oh, not with your, I mean, now people just go to him and ask him about Marvel movies just to be dumb, but back in the day I'd be like, oh, Martin Scorsese, he's a very serious filmmaker, so it's like, you know, going to be, you know, very serious and classical music and all, everything's gonna be classy. And it's like, I have to remind myself, not only did he do The Last Waltz, right, so it's like Martin Scorsese, for a little Italian man with glasses, he is rock and roll, man. Like, this movie, the style in this movie, the use of the soundtrack, which has classic music from the 40s and 50s and also rock music period pieces, it and his style, all the style flourishes, the attitude, the comedy that's mixed with the pathos, like, it is, to John's point, it was when I saw it in 1990, and it is to this day, breathtaking about the pure skill and style that Martin Scorsese has as a filmmaker. It's amazing.
I think, Jason, the reason you thought that about Martin Scorsese is because he's often grouped in with your Spielberg, Lucas, Francis Ford Coppola, Brian De Palma, all the film school guys.
Yeah.
And
didn't they have a name? It was like the Brat Pack of the film. Didn't they have like a name like the Brat Pack? What was it?
Something like that.
Hollywood.
Yeah. Spielberg and Lucas made the commercial films, and Coppola made the prestige films at the time.
Yeah.
And Brian De Palma was the Hitchcock ripoff guy. But Martin Scorsese was the guy who had to make Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore to prove that he could actually make commercial movies people wanted to see.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of the music, that's the other overriding thing about this movie is, like, yes, he's very good at making movies, and this movie is phenomenal and amazing in just every possible aspect. But also, as a kid of the MTV generation, I grew up when MTV debuted, and I remember when it first came on the air, it was a big thing at the babysitter that I went to.
Yeah, I was going to say, so do we, John, but school. Our references are a little bit later than yours, clearly.
I know, but I was only a couple years, two or three. I know it makes a big difference when you're, you know, 8 versus 11 or whatever, right. But yeah, I grew up on MTV. I love the concept of music video. In fact, I'm probably going to put something on my blog about it in the near future. I love music videos. I like the combination of, you know, video, television, movie with music, with the music being an important and dominant part of it. Is it because I grew up watching MTV, or did I love MTV because I love music videos? I don't know. But this movie is very much a series of music videos in a way that not a lot of movies are. And a lot of people say that, you know, like, hey, you know, Star Wars or Indiana Jones, you know, to give Lucas and Spielberg type things of, like, the music is so important in them, or even Spielberg with Jaws. But so many parts of this, music videos is the one reference. And the second is The concept of a montage. How many movies do we know where there are beloved sections of them that are montages? Even if you pick a movie that most people didn't like the beginning of Watchmen with the times they are changing or whatever song they use for that opening montage.
That's it.
Even people who hate that movie like the montage because it is essentially a music video. And this movie is like, what if you were skilled enough to make an entire movie as satisfying as the best montages from other movies that you've seen? And I think he pulls it off so much so that when the music actually stops playing, it is an incredibly dramatic, you know, moment. What's so funny about me? You know what I mean? Like that becomes a tool of the director because the whole rest of the movie is essentially series of the most amazing music videos you've ever seen, blended with dialogue, blended with cinematography, blended with the story. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, Then He Kissed Me by the Crystals is that long shot entering the Copacabana from through the kitchen. And the last, of course, that last segment that's got the
jump into the fire and
jump into the fire keeps coming back, and then there's all the other things. Monkey Man is in there, Magic Bus is in there, where it's the May 11th, 1980, and the paranoia with the helicopter and oh so much cocaine, and yes. that is like a playlist that is a music video of that moment. And the movie is essentially, it's unscored. The score is the three dozen songs from throughout the 20th century that Martin Scorsese is using to elaborate everything that's going on in the film.
The whole movie, because it's kind of like, you know, kind of like in Magnolia, where the Amy Mann songs like are the backbone of that movie. It's not like that music is on in the background or like is just there to set a mood. Like it drives everything about it. It drives the cuts, it drives the scenes, it drives when people are allowed to talk, because they put the music so far forward in the mix that they have to sort of interleave and integrate the dialogue to let the dialogue, they duck music for a second so you can hear a line and then the music comes back. It is just so dominant and, you know, moves the entire movie along.
The thing that always impressed me, and the music is great, is it's the most effective use of voiceover ever in a movie. Because voiceover is generally regarded as the narrative crutch of storytelling.
Tell, don't show.
Yeah. But you cannot really imagine this movie without a voice. It's the opposite of Blade Runner, where they had to put in the voiceover because this movie makes no goddamn sense. So, but if you took out the voiceover, I think I'm not sure it would be as effective or affecting a movie as Goodfellas turned out to be.
Yeah, and he's not narrating what's going on the screen, like, at all. It's as if, you know, that's the interleaving of these things. Like, I think at one point, one of my favorite parts is you've got the music, and you've got the dad walking in saying, so you have a good day at school today? Learned a lot, right? And the voiceover going all at the same time, and the video. So you've got all three of those things happening simultaneously, and the voice is not telling you what's happening in the movie scene or describing, hey, this one day this thing happened to me. The voice is just opining about childhood and sometimes you have to take a beating. And then the song is playing and then the dad is interleaving between the song and the voiceover, but still so you can hear what he's saying as he menacingly walks forward and asks the kid if he had a good day at school today. And, you know, and then, of course, the freeze frame stuff with him with the belt in the air. It's just the degree of difficulty of everything that is done in this movie is so high. It's like, not only do you have to have mastered the basics, but to even dare to try to do what is done in this movie is so ill-advised for almost anybody else. It should have been a disaster. And then, oh, and by the way, we're going to have a voiceover through most of the movie. It's just like, if you took the list of things this movie does and gave them as directions to somebody, you would make the worst movie ever. It's phenomenal that this movie came out as well as it did.
Watching it this most recent time, the thing that made me sit up and go, oh, I love cinema so much, is right at the end when suddenly Ray Liotta is talking to the camera instead of doing the voiceover. Yes.
It's like he's finishing his narration, right? In that moment. Yeah.
I mean, and I always thought of it as like Martin Scorsese saying, you've seen what I've done in the rest of this movie. You've seen what I'm doing with the music, with the cinematography, with the shots, with the camera motion, with the dialogue. You've seen all that. guess what? There's nothing I can't do. Yeah. Break the fourth wall? Yeah. Don't you think that would destroy my movie? No, it'll be so seamless. You will accept it so willingly, even though I've never done it for the rest of this movie and will not do it again, really, until the very end. You will just accept it because I have you 100%. And it will not feel jarring. It will feel as natural as every other thing I did in this movie. And it's just such a show-off move, such a, like, I have you and you know it. There is literally nothing I can't do at this moment. And it does. It works.
Yeah, it works.
Yeah, great. It's breathtaking because it's that moment where you're like, oh, wait, he's talking to me. And like, he's in the courtroom. He's literally been acting and is in the courtroom and the actors are all still there. And he's now talking to us as the camera pulls back. And it is this moment of like, you've been listening to me tell this story all along. And here I am at the end of the movie.
Yeah, and it's all over. Like, it's timed perfectly with the script and the story. Like, there's no part of this movie that is not pulling its weight, because that moment has to come then, because then he's like, and it was all over, right? Like, and that is the, you know, the cap on the top of the whole story.
Now, I'm glad Phil mentioned the narration. I was going to come to that next, because I think the music and the narration really do go together. I had a couple notes here about, first off, about Ray Liotta's narration as Henry Hill. From the beginning, in terms of the writing here is so good in defining his voice. The screenplay was Martin Scorsese and Nick Pileggi, who wrote the book that it's based on. And like, from the moment where, like, I always wanted to be a gangster, it is, the voice is so clear that you know who Henry Hill is. You get it. And yet the movie is happy to undercut it, right? Because it's like, hey, there's a guy in the trunk and he isn't dead yet, so we're going to have to stab him a bunch of times and shoot him. Oh, man, I always wanted to be a gangster, right? Like, it is this eyes open, like, you know, and I want to talk about the lack of romanticism of gangsters in this movie too. But like, I love that we are listening to him and we get an idea of who he is. And the other part of this that I had forgotten, I wasn't really thinking about it when I watched it because it's been a few years, that I laughed out loud when it happens, is I had forgotten the moment where Karen takes over the narration, Lorraine Bracco.
That's another great moment of showing that he's, you know, I can do anything here. Like, he's been narrating this whole movie for like an hour. Guess what? I'm going to change narrators. So
he's not the only narrator.
That happens in the book. I've read the book a couple of times.
Yeah,
and
they alternate between Karen and Henry as the narrators of the book.
Yeah, but the movie like keeps you in Henry's point of view so rigorously that it really comes out of nowhere with like, oh yeah. Here's, well, that's my Lorraine Bracco. It's very good.
It's
here on the podcast with us. Hello, Lorraine.
They meet, and it is sort of the movie saying like, no, she's the one, right? Like, this is because she gets to narrate too, so she's in this with him. But it is just such a moment, and we keep coming back to it, and it's like, I'm sorry to mention this because it's a much lesser work of art, and yet in some ways I was thinking about how it's similar. Is Phil and I do a podcast about Magnum PI, and there's some episodes of Magnum PI because he does a voiceover.
Reminded of Magnum PI watching this. No,
it's all related to Magnum PI. No, but there are a couple episodes that tickle me because he always does voiceovers on that show. And then occasionally a character comes along and steals the voiceovers, and it makes me laugh because it's like, oh, show, you set me up, and now you're going to subvert my expectations. And this movie, when Karen comes in, you're like, oh no, what just happened? And then we get Karen's perspective, and that happens throughout too. It's great. And Lorraine Bracco, you know, Monty really pretty much nailed it there with his impression of Lorraine Bracco. So what more can we say about that? Now, the narration is great.
It's not the movie that we're here to talk about, but since we're talking about tricks that Martin Scorsese plays with narration, Casino also uses voiceover, not as effectively, has multiple people who just take their narration over from each other. And the best trick in that is Joe Pesci is doing the narration just as he's murdered and the narration stops. It's like, I was telling them I'm not going to get tricked. Oh, as he's hit on the head with a bat.
So there I am lying in a ditch in a cornfield, right?
Yeah. I mean, spoiler alert for Casino if you haven't seen that in the last 30 years.
Yeah, he gets it.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around.
Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Oh my God, there's so much here. So the story structure. So we begin with that moment where they are taking Billy Batts out to the upstate to bury him. I believe in the book it's actually like it's like an animal preserve or something like that, that like people but anyway, it doesn't matter. He's literally, they took him to a farm upstate.
Yeah, and we don't know who he is at that point, but like you said, that scene serves as the opening movie. I think that is an important stage setting scene because I think it's important for the movie to communicate that it's not going to be The Godfather.
Yes.
Like, the whole point of the very first scene is that it's not, as romanticized as you think the gangster life is, this is not that movie. Even though the voiceover is
messy
saying,
and smelly.
Yeah. It, like, sometimes you just got to go to the trunk and restab the guy who you thought was dead. And it's not important that you know who he is. And the magic of this movie is that, at least the first time I watched it, I remember, you know, that scene, getting the message of that scene. Then the movie goes and it sucks you in. And by the time they loop back around to that, it's like, oh, I've forgotten about the guy in the trunk. Because it's the opening scene of the movie and you've never seen it before. Yeah. So you're just like, you know, the movie just sweeps you up into it. And then you resync with that. It's amazing.
And you get by backing up, and setting the stage about how this is not glamorous, it's actually, I think, so brilliantly done in that Ray Liotta's narration and the music and Rags to Riches by Tony Bennett it's like Happy Days for gangsters, right? It's like, it's the 50s and Paul Sorvino doesn't have a phone in his house and only talks to one person at a time. And I got money and people carried mom's groceries out of respect. And hey, you look like a gangster.
And even though I forget what song it is, but the big swell of music when the guy's coming down the street saying, they shot me, and he's bleeding all over the place. Like, even when they cut back to the, hey, even when he's a kid and he's helping out, it's great that he gets to park people's Cadillacs, but also occasionally a guy stumbles along with blood all over him and he gets yelled at for using too many aprons, right?
Yeah, and that's like opera.
Or you have to blow up some Cadillacs too.
Well, that's part of the fun part, I think.
Yeah.
But, and so that is, I love that the movie starts with the ugliness so that when we get Henry Hill's like, this is why I wanted to become a gangster, right? It's right in that first line, right? It's like something terrible just happened. He's like, I always wanted to be a gangster. And it's like, he's starting his story from the beginning where it's romantic, except we are not there. We are in 1970 and it is not romantic. And it is a perfect sort of scene setting for what I think is, and I would love to hear what you all think about this, what I think is one of this movie's greatest strengths, which is The Godfather, a movie that I love, a movie that is deservedly beloved as one of the great movies of all time. But The Godfather is a very romantic kind of movie about the people at the top
Godfather. I feel like The Godfather is self-serious in a way this movie isn't a little bit, but especially when you combine it with The Godfather Part 2, we're not going to talk about Part 3, I always hold up The Godfather movies as, although it glamorizes the gangster life and as showing them as, you know, as the good guys, the Corleone family with ideals, and they're conquering the people who are trying to kill them. And so you're rooting for them and not really concentrating too much about how they're actually organized crime is bad and everything like that. But really, the movie Part 1 and Part 2 combined are essentially a story of how someone trying to do the right thing, making individual decisions, each of which seems like the morally and ethically best choice in the given situation, the accumulation of those decisions can leave you in the place where Michael is at the end of Godfather Part 2.
It's still a bad business. I agree with all that.
But I was saying, like, it is a tragedy. It is showing, hey, you've been rooting for this guy, and he's been trying to do the right things, but look where he ended up. It doesn't have a happy ending.
It is a tragedy, but it is a tragedy like a Shakespearean tragedy is a tragedy about kings and rulers and people at the top. And what I think I love about Goodfellas perhaps the most is that it's right in the name, right? Like, it's not about the kings, it's not about the top level people, it's about the low level and the dirtiest jobs and the crappy jobs and the things they're doing on the side to make money that are not really part of the big organization that's got like everything wired up. They're just kind of like doing
middle managers.
doing little dirty work underneath, and it is dirty work, and it is, so it's not directly opposed to The Godfather, but it is shaded in a way, because you're like, well, do we need more mob movies? I think is a question after The Godfather that everybody could ask, and then you see Goodfellas, and you're like, oh, well, we needed at least one more.
Yeah, because Joe Pesci is the only guy who could even get made. Our other two main characters can't be. Right. And so they're not only are they like the underlings, they're never going to rot, like they're not going to ever be the boss or anything close to the boss. And they know it.
The other thing, Jason, that is great about the opening dialogue is it establishes Henry Hill as the most unreliable narrator. take nothing this guy says at face value. And it's interesting reading interviews with Scorsese where he talks about this movie. He has absolute contempt for that character. He hates that character very much. And you very much see the part of Martin Scorsese that was going to be a priest coming through in this. Hmm. This is his homily, and it's all, let me tell you about a young boy I used to know, a no good Nick. And this is what happened to him.
At one point in the book, Henry Hill, it's late and he's been arrested, and he's like, okay, let me tell you everything I've done so I can get out of going to jail. And one of the things he did was point shaving on Boston College basketball games.
Yes.
And the FBI agent who went to Boston College almost goes over the table after him.
And in fact, that FBI agent is plays the prosecutor in the movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Speaking of the FBI, that's another, this movie is so well constructed with the voiceover at the beginning where he's talking about stuff or whatever. It's very early on, and I noted this when I was taking notes watching this again. Very early on, Henry brings up the FBI. Oh, that's the thing the FBI could never understand. It's small, it's subtle, but if you don't know where this movie is going, why is he mentioning the FBI in the first 5 minutes? That will probably be important later. Like, you get a hint at where he's narrating from, because, like you said, the narration is saying one thing, and then we're seeing something different on the screen. So, who is the Henry Hill that is narrating this, as we learn later, is the Henry Hill who is in witness protection for the FBI? But that lays the groundwork for you thinking, oh, I guess the FBI is going to come into this. And again, the movie, like, yanks you on this journey that you'll forget all about that until later the FBI starts to appear and you're like, oh yeah.
Yeah, I feel like the movie does a pretty good job too of every time you think you might start to be rooting for Henry Hill, it undercuts him in another way. And I'm sure there are people out there who just ignore that and still like him. But like, it tries very hard at all the points to undercut him. You get that moment where you're like, oh, look, Lorraine Bracco, she's great. And it's like immediately, but Friday nights were for wives, Saturday nights were for girlfriends. And it's like, boom, we've undercut him right there. And then later, it happens again and again. Until you get to the point where at the very end, not only has he done all these horrible things, but then he's done the horrible thing of his act of putting the bad guys behind bars is itself a complete betrayal of everything that he stood for up to that point. Like, there's nowhere that's good.
It's not a heroic act, even though it is like the right thing to do. It is not a heroic act. Like, one of the things this movie does very well, which I think is, I don't know what it was like in the book at all, but it makes it very clear what Henry's primary skill is. And it's almost as if like the viewer knows it, but none of his like coworkers or friends or whatever understand, like, what is he good at? He's not a tough guy who's good at beating people up. He's not a criminal mastermind. He's not particularly smart. His role within the organization is to figure out how to emotionally and politically navigate the other nut jobs that he works with. Knowing what, like the Joe Pesci situation, the read on that whole scene with like, what's so funny about me, is that Henry correctly calculates that whether he's serious or not, and I think the movie is saying that Joe Pesci was serious, the only way he can get out of this is to allow Joe Pesci to save face by saying, get the F out of here, to give him the out of it being a joke and that he was kidding around. But you can see his wheels turning at every moment when he's dealing with someone, whether it's trying to convince people not to kill Maury, or like trying to get someone to, trying to get people not to bother Jimmy about stuff.
Yeah.
The wheels are always turning. And he's basically like, he's like a really good social player on Survivor. And that's what he does within the organization. And that skill is not particularly valued, but it's literally the only thing that keeps him alive for most of this movie. And eventually, when he's, you know, high on cocaine at the end and those skills are, you know, mooted, then he's, you know, at the end of his rope and he's done. But like, it's very rare to see a gangster movie where the main character is like I said, the social player or on Survivor throughout the entire thing, which is not, it's not a trait that the movie admires really, but it is interesting in that he's not the sunny, he's not the mastermind like Michael. He is, his emotional intelligence keeps him alive for this whole film.
I would say that also he's, this movie is getting across the idea that like when you are a gangster, everybody you work with is a gangster. And yeah. It's not the cream of the crop, right? And so you've got your friends, right? But it's Tommy, Joe Pesci, who is terrifying. And it's Robert De Niro.
He's going to kill you someday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Robert De Niro is Jimmy. And Jimmy is the more like, you know, the quiet sociopath.
Who's eventually going to kill everyone you know.
Right. And then Henry is like trying to smooth it over. I think that's actually one of the reasons that Paul Sorvino, likes Henry is like Henry's personable, right? And Henry can be dealt with. And in fact, Henry can also like smooth things out. And that's valuable when you're the manager of gangsters, right? It's not great.
You definitely want a Henry Hill on your team and not a bunch of Tommies.
No.
Like, you want a Tommy, but you don't want to talk to
if
him.
If you have a lot of Tommies, they kill each other. So yeah, you're left with one
Tommy.
The
other people, like Carbone, who gets in the freezer, all the people that Jimmy kills eventually, all those people are not as much trouble as Tommy, but they're also not as smart as Henry or Jimmy.
Guys, are we writing a management book based on Goodfellas here?
Yeah,
this movie is basically a management guide for managing. You know,
what color is your mob parachute?
Who moved my cheese? No, literally, who moved it? I'm going to kill them.
You think I'm a mouse?
The movie makes the point that these are people like that. When you're in this life, yes, all your coworkers are mobsters, but they're also basically your family because they're your friends, they're your family, they're your entire life. You stay with them, you go on vacation with them, you see them at holidays, they're the only people who are at your wedding, they are your family. And even his wife going, talking about the other women and how they looked bad and would talk about how their husbands would kill people. And it's like, this is it. Eventually, you're just in this life and it becomes normal because all your friends also have the FBI visiting on them. You know, she's spinning her own floor. I never understood that. The movie does a good job of depositing the viewer into that life until it starts to seem normal to them, so that when it all falls apart at the end, it feels like normalcy is falling apart for us.
Since you mentioned the end, Ray Liotta is so convincing as somebody who is heavily on cocaine at the end of this movie.
Oh man,
oh, man.
That one might suspect that some people involved with the movie had some experience with cocaine.
Well, Martin Scorsese nearly died from a cocaine addiction. He was long over that by the time this movie came along. But he had some experience of how you live your life when you are really into cocaine.
Anybody in Hollywood in the 70s, I feel like, is a probably strong foundation to make a movie like this.
And to Monty's point, the movie, again, we're talking about the artistry of Martin Scorsese here. The movie makes you feel it, right? Like,
oh, yes.
The movie puts you high on cocaine, right? The movie on May 11th, 1980, 6:55 a.m. It's like, wake up, everybody. We are going to spend a day with a lot of cocaine in our system. And here, and the music's playing, and the camera, and like, the camera gets weird. And
yeah, the camera is usually so smooth, like going into
it starts darting around just like his eyes.
Yeah.
Well, Two things that I'd like to jump in on there. One, whenever my wife and I have a lot of errands and just a crazy day, like one of us will turn to the other and go, you want to see helicopters?
Yep.
The second thing is, since we're talking about the camera work, Michael Bauhaus is the director of photography on this movie. He collaborated with Scorsese a bunch of times, but he is really one of the unsung heroes of this movie because he just shoots it beautifully and does the things like changing up the way that the camera handles the scene during the May 11th scene. He was the guy who choreographed the Steadicam shot through the
Copacabana.
Yeah. He is absolutely fantastic and this is his masterwork, I think, as a DOP.
Yeah, I think the Copacabana scene, you know, the Steadicam going through the kitchen gets all the attention, but my favorite camera move in that whole thing is after they sit down at the table and the waiter says, this is from those people over there for you, and he pans the camera to the left to show the people the table, and they raise their glasses, and then he brings it back. That's like, it's probably one of my favorite camera moves in all of cinema, yep. because it is such a perfect... sort of like they never get fully in the frame. Like you're not shifting the attention over to them.
Doesn't
but you're
matter
just like,
who
ah,
they are.
Well, these guys over here.
It's the head on the swivel thing that throughout it you are basically tagging along. You're the third wheel on their date.
Yeah, you're Lorraine Bracco because you're just mm-hmm. dizzy from like everything, and she gets a chance. It's like she would just glance over. Oh, the people sent me, and there's a table is flying in, and we're going through the kitchen and this and that.
Oh God, it's Henny Youngman.
I'm in construction.
See, John, one of my favorite shots in the movie is when they're in the bar and they're discussing the Air France thing, and they wave Robert De Niro over, and it does that really fast zoom in on him. And as the again with the soundtrack, the music is going dun 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 dun.
Yeah, and then he stands up real quick. Yeah,
uh-huh. That is class.
It's just every time the camera is moving in this thing, it is working in concert with the actors, the script, and the music to convey something. It is never like there's no unmotivated movement. It's just such a beautiful orchestration of everything working together. It gets so rare to do because they have to time it. They have to time it to the dialogue of the people speaking. They have to time it to the voiceover, and they have to time it to the music, like the editing, the editing on this, just to get this to all work together. So everyone says all their things at the right spot. It's just
Thomas Schoonmaker. I watch it. She's great.
Thomas Schoonmaker.
Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. The that May 11th scene too. Look for the helicopters. Always look for the helicopters. The music is always going. And then I just every time I am struck by how boy, Henry Hill, for a liar and he's just an awful person. He's also an overachiever. Let's just admit it. Because he's like, okay, here's what I'm going to do today. Well, I got to have a lot of cocaine and the helicopters are following me because they're not, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. But I'm also going to make dinner and it's going to be ziti with the meat gravy and the peppers. And I got to get the cocaine to the babysitter, but I got to whack it with quinine first at Sandy's place.
Got to pick up my brother at the hospital too. Yeah.
I got to sell these guns, but he doesn't want the guns. I got to sell the guns to somebody else.
I got to sell these parts of guns that don't go together. Yeah. And the guy,
Robert De Niro trying to put the silencers on the guns and doing the Robert De Niro shrug and going, eh, and Henry just going, these. Fine. I didn't say a word. I just left.
it's fine. And I got to do that. And then I got to go back to that. And I got to make sure the babysitter doesn't call from the house.
Oh, he hides the guns at his mother-in-law's house to wait till the helicopters go away in a paper bag.
I would like amazing. To point out that one, a couple years ago on May 11th, I actually made the Goodfellas gravy.
I think it's time for the IMDb goofs here.
Okay? Yes.
Because as you just all mentioned, right, Jason, he was going to make his brother Michael's favorite, which is ziti with meat gravy.
Later
in that scene, they have a shot that starts zoomed in on the table. That's rigatoni in that bowl. I'm sorry.
Oh. No.
IMDb goofs.
What a goof. But
I do not like the phrase meat gravy. Can I just say that?
No. Ragu will work. Ragu. And let me just say,
and peppers.
If you were to make that and eat it at 10 o'clock at night, as apparently they do, you would need lots of cocaine to be awake.
Yeah, because you'd be up all night with the reflux.
Yeah. Oh,
no,
my God.
You fall right to sleep.
So much meat in that. You just know I'm in a meat coma.
Yeah. And then like 2 hours later, you wake up with reflux. Anyway, it is an amazing scene. Now, the thing that I had conflated the two music cues, because it's actually, there's that wild May 11th music cue, which is the Harry Nilsson song. The other amazing music video, John, of right before it is the Layla piano exit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
It is like the Goodfellas version of when they deal with all family business in The Godfather. But in this case, what it is, and the more you think about it, because you could miss it, and I think I might have missed it the first time, or at least it carried me along, but it is a romantic montage of Robert De Niro deciding he's just going to kill everybody else who was involved in the Lufthansa heist.
Keep all the money.
And keep the money. Because
they deserve
all spending
it. They bought the pink Cadillac.
on Cars and Furs when he told them not to. So now he's just decided he's going to kill them all to the Layla piano exit.
And the fact that Henry, the only reason Henry's not being killed is because Henry is smart and wasn't greedy and said, look, I got the little finder's fee for finding you this thing, but I'm not in on it. I'm not asking for the money. And so he just does what Henry does, which is save his own skin by knowing when it's time to sit back and let Jimmy kill a bunch of people that he's known all his life.
I love that Frank Barone, the non-Tommy assassin who comes in with his wife in the furs, doesn't even argue. Like, oh, yeah, okay, I'll get rid of it. Yeah, all right. I like that a guy is a professional killer and also a complete pushover.
Well, just a nincompoop, too.
Yeah.
Since we're on that scene, I want to call out Robert De Niro here, who, in recent years, his selection of material is somewhat questionable.
Yeah.
As, I heard the intern was good.
As he,
I did.
He is either, you know, funding other projects or just trying to leave a legacy for people and in terms of money. But I feel that his star has dimmed somewhat, and I think he does some really good work in this, particularly in the scene where you can see the wheels spinning in his head and he's deciding who he's going to kill.
Mm-hmm.
It's that scene where he and Henry are walking. And you can just see the eyes shifting back and forth, Robert De Niro, as he's calculating all the scenarios. And the moment where he decides to kill Maury,
yeah,
he the corner of his mouth just sort of curls up like the Grinch getting a Grinchy idea. Idea, and it is fantastic.
And we get the voiceover right there, which is like, and that's when I knew he was going to kill Maury. Right?
Yeah. Well, and then this movie also shows that Jimmy is the only one who is even close to being a match for Henry in terms of scheming, because Henry, Henry trying to save Maury, you know, out of the goodness of his heart mostly, but just that's just kind of his role as like the peacemaker and settle things down. He's at the card game and he's got to try to convince Jimmy not to kill Maury. And then Jimmy leans over and says, you know, things I forget about it. I'm not going
to
do it.
Yeah. And it's supposed to be, he thinks it's a mercy for Maury. It's actually a mercy for Henry, right? I'm not going to make you.
Jimmy knows that Henry is there sweating the whole time saying, oh, how am I going to convince Jimmy? So Jimmy puts Henry at ease.
Yep.
And it's the only time he is sort of emotionally and politically outsmarted in this movie by Jimmy saying, Don't worry about it.
Don't worry about it.
We're not. I've decided that thing. I decided I'm not going to do it. He's totally going to do it.
Yeah. This is, you're not, I'm not going to have you do it.
Immediately thereafter.
Yeah.
Okay. Picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Talking about some of the characters in this, Robert De Niro, Robert De Niro, long history with Martin Scorsese, Raging Bull,
Taxi Driver.
Yes. Long history there. And I think that trust between them let somebody like Robert De Niro, who at this time was absolutely thought of as one of our great actors, take a part that is first off, he and Joe Pesci are the seconds to Ray Liotta, a guy who most of us had never heard of, or like, is it the guy from Field of Dreams? right?
It's the guy, the right-handed guy who played left-hander Shoeless Joe Jackson.
Exactly.
From Field of Dreams, yeah.
And so that's
noted Southerner, Ray Liotta. Yeah.
so that's one thing. And then the second thing is, among the second level guys in this movie, one of the parts is real showy and the other is not. And Robert De Niro took that part and he is fantastic. But I also like the fact that he took the part, right? Because he knew he was going to get overshadowed by Joe Pesci, and that really, it's really Ray Liotta's movie, but De Niro does masterful work throughout. The scene, one of my favorite scenes in any movie ever, is after all of the May stuff goes down and Lorraine Bracco comes over to him because she's desperate for money. And he says, "Oh, I got some coats just down there. Keep going down there."
Yeah.
And she looks and there's some guys in the shadowy like thing. She's like, "Oh, no, Jimmy, I'm going to go." And she peels out. And it is the most like, just like
terrifying.
It's congenially menacing is what he's doing there. It's just amazing. It's really remarkable.
And I think we're all agreed she was absolutely going to be murdered.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, you could see it in, like, why would Jimmy be so insistent that she needs to go in somewhere? Like, it's just, I mean, the part of the whole thing of this movie, this movie kind of really cemented the trope that, you know, like how supervillains always have to have an elaborate way to kill you, or James Bond villains always have an elaborate way to kill you. Well, this movie cemented the trope that when the mob kills you, it always has to, they always have to like put you at ease first and make you think you're not going to be killed, to almost to a hilarious degree. It's like, look, if you're just going to kill him, just kill him. But no, it's really important for you to like think, to make Joe Pesci think he's going to be made, and to escort him and celebrate with him right up to the moment where he dies. Right up to that moment, it's like, oh yeah, no, we're doing this thing. It's
great.
We
even rented a room for you.
Yeah, they're joking with Maury when he gets in the seat. What are we going to get? Do they have Danish there? Yeah, they have Danish ice pick to the back of the head. Like, it's right up to the moment you die. They're your friends. And so that is the whole thing of like, oh, I got some furs for you or whatever. And like what she did by hesitating is she drew out that moment, right? Yeah. That the switch from like, oh no, I got some stuff, we're friendly, it should be, and immediately dead. But she pauses, and now we're left with this menace of going, wait, this is the moment, this is the gap between when they're being friendly and when you're being dead. And then she runs away in her Volvo.
So good.
But to get back to your point, Jason, I think if I recall correctly, it was kind of a condition of Scorsese getting money to make the movie that
De Niro be in it.
That he get De Niro in it somehow. Because, you know, they're not going, Paul Sorvino is in this again. Movie. Here's a wheelbarrow full of money.
Every Italian-American actor in New York is in this movie.
Yeah, I think it's De Niro's generosity and being so good and so big, and also having that relationship with Scorsese that he's like, yeah, I'll do that part. And he kills it. But, like, I would say, it's not every day that you would get an actor of this stature at this point in his career willing to do this, you know, third most important actor in the movie, but he was willing to do it here. It's like the idea of, like, you know, that great character actor who's totally unsung, and then they're in a movie and you're like, oh my God, that great character actor was so good in that. Well, it's like, that's what this part is, except it's Robert De Niro doing it. It's like, well, okay, yeah.
Well, you know, Robert De Niro had obviously worked with Martin Scorsese before. Yeah. He probably found it relaxing not to have to go full Travis Bickle for...
I agree. I think his agent might have been like, why are you doing this? And it's like, it's Marty. It's fine.
Well, with his future film choices, I think his agent probably stopped asking that question.
Yeah, eventually. Learned to stop asking. This? So Joe Pesci. Tommy is a hothead, and again,
he's a bad seed. What do you want me to do?
He's
got a temper.
You get the one of the nice things is you get the shorthand before you really get into the characters. So you get that scene where it's like, it's Jimmy and Tommy and me and Anthony and Frankie and Mo Black's brother Fred Andy and Pete the Killer, who is Sally Ball's brother, and Nicky Eyes and Mickey and Chase and Jimmy two times because he said everything two times, right?
Gotta, like, go get the papers, get the papers.
It's so amazing. And then and it's like everybody's a character, and it's like, okay, Tommy, what's Tommy's character? And you get that you think I'm funny, I'm a clown, I amuse you scene. And we talked about it before. And John said he's probably not joking, and Henry kind of like makes it that he's joking. He may be joking, he may not be joking. What's great about it is that even though in that moment he doesn't do anything to Henry and they all have a laugh,
he takes it out on the waiter. He
does do that. But in that moment, everybody is silent because it's clear that this is Tommy. That when Tommy is going off, anything can happen. And we see he smashes the bottle into the guy's face. And then later we see with Spider, right? like he doesn't take it from Spider and he shoots him in the foot and then Spider gives him some crap later and he shoots him many times. His
non-emotionally intelligent friends goad him on and say, are you going to take that?
Yeah.
What are you doing telling, saying that to Tommy? Because Henry gives him the out. Henry gives him a way to leave that while saving face.
Yeah, but Jimmy is the quiet.
You pull one over me.
Jimmy is the quiet sociopath,
yeah,
though.
Yeah. Jimmy does not give him an out. Jimmy teases him until he kills him.
Do I want this kid to be alive or do I want to bust Tommy's balls? I want to bust Tommy's balls and see what happens.
I think Tommy is kidding in that scene, but if Henry doesn't find a good way out of it, he's going to get killed anyway.
Well, because once Tommy's on a roll, right? That's part of it. That's part of that where he's like, no, I don't understand. Tell me, explain it to me. Like Joe Pesci.
Once he's decided that there's an ego threat, once his reputation or ego is threatened in any way, there is no way out.
Yeah. And Joe Pesci is so, he's so good. I mean, like, breaking news, Joe Pesci's good in Goodfellas. But like, what makes Joe Pesci so good as an actor and so good as a fit for this part is that he's such a good fast talker and a builder upper of language, where Joe Pesci is just one of those guys who he starts to get on a roll and his voice keeps getting higher and he's like, what are you doing now? And what are you doing now? And he's going to explode. And he is like, he is going to explode.
Does.
So
literally
perfect.
Explodes. I feel badly for people who haven't seen the movie because
those poor suckers
in general.
Well,
they had 32
because
years.
At this point, even if you haven't seen the movie, you're aware of that scene. And having seen the movie the opening weekend, when that scene came on, that was the moment for me when I said, "Oh my God, this is the greatest movie ever made."
Yeah.
There is no way that any movie that will come before or after this can top this moment.
I think it still works because in the moment of relief, he then just turns his frustration on the other guy.
Yeah,
so even if you're watching, you're like, oh, that's that famous scene. Oh, I'm relieved. Oh, no, now he's smashing the guy's head with a bottle.
Just reminding you that this guy is going to be a problem, that even Henry can't actually, all he can do is diffuse and deflect. But in the end, Tommy's a bad seat.
Also, one of the best laughs that the movie got at that first screening I went to is in the opening scene when Joe Pesci pulls the giant knife out of his coat to chop up Billy Bats, and the audience just loses it at that point.
It's even better to see where he gets the knife from later.
I was going to say that wonderful scene.
Borrow this knife, Mom.
Because, you know, mobsters have moms. We're at, and it's Martin Scorsese's mom. Is Joe Pesci's mom in this movie, and they have that really funny this movie is very funny.
It's hilarious.
That's one of the beautiful things about it. And it mixes the funny with the horror in amazing ways. But that scene with Joe Pesci's mom, and they're talking and they're telling stories, and she says, "Oh, how about this painting?" And it's the two, "Oh, I like it. The dogs are pointing. Mm-hmm. One dog's going that way, and the other dog's going this way."
Did Tommy ever tell you about my painting?
It's just and that is so great. And then he's like, Ma, I gotta borrow a knife. We hit a deer on the road. I gotta it's a gristle in there. And
the paw. What do you call the paw?
Yeah, and he's just bring it back. And he's like, oh yeah, Mom, you know me, I'll bring it back. And then we already know that he's gonna stab that guy with it multiple times before De Niro is like, you know, the knife didn't work that great before. I'm just gonna shoot him a lot.
HBO Max has an introduction by Martin Scorsese on Goodfellas, and half of it is about that scene.
Right.
It seemed like a lot of it was improvised with them just around the table coming up with things
other than the painting, where you can see it cuts back to her and she's now got the painting below and she's like, did you see my painting? Because they wanted to do the thing with the painting. But
that's his mother, Martin Scorsese's mother, and she considered De Niro and Pesci like her kids anyway because they'd been friends for so long. So she was able to just roll with it.
And Henry just sort of sits there and watches, and they're like, oh, look, you, Henry, you're just sitting here watching. And it's like, yeah, that's what I do.
And she's got a story about that.
And she does. And then Billy Bats, we should say. So like, when we talk about what makes Tommy tick, like Billy Bats is this made man. He's gotten out of prison after 6 years. And he is joking about Tommy and saying, you know, when I remember you, you were a kid who shined shoes. And then he's like, no, I'm just busting your balls. And then he does it again. He twists it and he's like, get your shine box. And so Pesci leaves there's so much character detail in here, because De Niro in this scene is so restrained, right? He doesn't say the wrong thing. He just sort of says, you did insult him a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Like, says, little bit.
And we know from what happens next, which is once Pesci comes back after the place is cleared out.
Well, before he left, he said, keep him here. Yeah. He's telling his two other friends, like, they both know what's going to happen. Keep him here.
Yeah. And as soon as he goes down, De Niro is into it, right? De Niro is
stomping
on the guy. He's not like, this is Tommy's thing. He's like, again, quiet sociopath. He's like, he's ready to do it too. And they keep him there. And then the last line in there is like, I didn't want to get blood on your floor, he says.
That's when he puts
like,
it, puts him on the tablecloth. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's good that you care.
Yeah. Speaking of those two things, like, so De Niro is famous actor by the time this movie comes along, known for so many things, you know, like, but this movie defines either redefined or replaced or put into the public consciousness so many things that are associated with Robert De Niro. You insulted him a little bit, the stomping with the foot. Those two things alone have dwarfed anything else that Robert De Niro is known for in his career previous to that. You would think like Marlon Brando, who'd be known for all like the Godfather things. It's as if Marlon Brando did a movie later that replaced all the things that people knew him for the Godfather. When everyone brought up Marlon Brando, everyone said you insulted him a little bit and did the foot stomp. Like, even though he had a minor role in this movie, it sort of redefined who Robert De Niro was to maybe just to an entire generation of people who didn't know him from back then. But it is very, very iconic for the few small things that he does.
I think that's a little strong. Like, Taxi Driver has some memorable lines.
You're talking to me, it survived for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Ray Liotta. Again, yes.
Speaking of best laughs.
Oh, my God.
Internet meme, Ray Liotta.
Yeah, but the fact that he, like, even on the poster, he's off to the side and Robert De Niro's in the middle, right? Mm. But, like, this is his movie, and he is, like, hey, he was Shoeless Joe in Field of Dreams, right? Like, and he is great in this movie. The narration is great. His performance is great. It is a career making and career defining moment for him, but he's up to it. He's up to it, and he is so likable while being an utterly despicable character. It is a real neat trick and really well done. And
yeah, it's a good audience proxy because he seems the most normal of all the psychopaths that he's amongst. And the audience relates to him as if I was in that situation, how would I survive? And we watch Henry trying to pull it off until the wheels come off later, obviously, which again helps that he's the audience proxy with the wheels coming off. But I remember reading about this. I think that Scorsese had to do a lot of arguing to allow Ray Liotta to be cast in this because, you know, everyone involved in the movie is going to think, I like your other casting choices. I'm not sure about this guy. It turns out it was fine.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and again, like I said, this was my motive. I've been holding this one as, you know, we've done, you know, 600 odd episodes. And it's like, I've been holding this one because I've absolutely wanted to do it at some point. And when Ray Liotta passed away, I was like, okay, we got to do this. We got to talk about this thing because it's a great performance. And so I want to mention Lorraine Bracco. Not a lot of women in this movie. Lorraine Bracco, we already talked about. She takes over for the narration at a few points, which is great. I she's so charismatic as well. It is a really good, she holds up the screen there too with Ray Liotta. They are both doing a great job here.
She's a match for him. They make that point pretty early on when she's angry of getting stood up by him, when she's holding the gun to his face later.
Obviously,
she has a different point of view than her husband in this movie in terms of what's important, but she is so up to going toe-to-toe to him. The scene with her chucking the bread out of her long overcoat in the jail is just...
the meet-cute is so funny, too, because it's the set up on a double date, doesn't want to be there. Ray Liotta is like, can I pay the bill? Can we go? Because he really doesn't want to be there with her. Then they set her up on another double date. He doesn't come, right?
Mm-hmm. And she makes Tommy go take her back to yell at him.
Yeah. And then, and yet you know, in the end, it all. And then when she comes in as the narrator, you're like, oh, okay, all right.
She comes in, the narrator says, you know, I know, you know, some people like my friends who would have been out of there the minute their boyfriend gave them a gun to hide. But yeah. She's got to admit it turned her on. And that's that explains. So that, powerful. That's that. Mazel tov.
That guy that hits on her or does something, we don't know exactly what.
Exactly.
And gets just he pistol whipped.
Touching me. He had wandering hands.
He sexually assaulted her in some way, right? Yeah. For sure, we would say today. Absolutely.
That guy has some guts. When he sees Ray Liotta coming at him, and he's like,
I don't know that. Yeah, I don't know that it's guts. I think he has the unearned arrogance of a wealthy man.
Exactly.
His friends know what's up. They back up. They're like, no, don't shoot.
Well, they only back up after the pistol whip.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, here's the thing that I think says I'm a gangster more than anything else is like he's dating Lorraine Bracco. He's dating Karen. Uh-huh. She lives. Her family lives across the street. They went to school together. This is not like a man came up to me somewhere randomly and beat me savagely with a gun. This is literally the guy who's dating Karen across the street came over here. And I know like he sexually assaulted her. It is unlikely that anything is going to come to this, but I like the boldness of I am a gangster. I don't care that this is out in the daylight and everybody on the neighborhood block can see it and everybody knows who I'm with and whose house that is. Doesn't matter. I'm just going to go beat that guy up a little bit and say, never look at her again. And
it makes the same point that he does later in the movie. There is no tough guy talk. There is no yelling. There is no arguing. He just walks straight up to him purposefully in an amazing shot and just bang, 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 bang.
This is my solution.
It's a callback to the thing that De Niro says earlier when they're robbing a truck driver. It's, you may know who we are, but we definitely know.
Yeah, and he doesn't have to make any point, and he doesn't have to make the argument. He just does that, and then he does say, "Before you touch her again, and I'll kill you." Right?
Yeah.
But I think the point is made without that.
By the way, if you're doing the tag yourself as a character in the movie, I am literally the guy who is standing there going,
"Don't shoot!
Don't shoot!" That's me. Except there's a wet spot in my pants.
Yeah,
I'm the Corvette in the driveway.
Yes. Okay. Any young call lady. Me, I can be a coward.
I'm the dog that's facing left.
Yeah.
One goes one way, one goes the other. Who cares? All right. What else is going on here? Saturday night was for wives. Friday night was for girlfriends, I mentioned, because we do get this series, because not only is there Janice Rossi, where we get the whole thing where later Karen is like, Janice Rossi. There's a whore living in 2R. 2R Rossi, you're nothing but a whore.
Yeah, I was about to say, Jason, please announce her properly. She's Janice Rossi, the whore living in 2R.
In 2R. And then also there's Debbie Mazur as Sandy, a recognizable actress. I'm like, hey, it's Debbie Mazur. And she's Sandy. And she's around. And then later, we discover at a later point, she is his cocaine-fueled cutting the cocaine while they have sex girlfriend that he has, because the many women.
He noticed that was another great scene where he notices her. He's in Janice's apartment, throws her on the bed. All the girls are in the room looking, Ray's getting all horny, throwing his girlfriend on the bed. They all start leaving the room, and he locks eyes with what's her name, cocaine girl, and
Sandy,
she starts backing out of the room, and she bumps into the doorframe as she's exiting because she's so mesmerized by that. Mm-hmm. It's just so good.
This movie is literally the hey, it's that Goomba of movies.
Oh yeah,
because you get your Polly Walnuts is in an early scene.
Christopher.
Yeah,
Michael Imperioli.
Michael Imperioli. Yeah. You get Samuel L. Jackson is Stax. Everyone loves Stax.
Yeah.
Isaiah Whitlock Jr. is in there as the doctor. The only person, by the way, in this movie who is kind to Ray Liotta and who is just trying to be nice to him.
Give him a Valium.
Yeah.
Sent him on his way.
Yeah. So,
and the guy who owned Rouse in New York, he's Johnny Dio and he eventually went on to play the FBI head FBI guy in The Sopranos. Basically, this was The Sopranos audition
pilot
for a lot of people.
Pilot episode.
I was going to say that this is the rare movie that shows members of the mob being shaken up by the acts of violence committed by themselves and their colleagues. Mm-hmm. Right, like that most mobster movies show the mobsters doing horrible acts of violence, but this movie very often shows in almost every scene where someone is getting shot, punched, killed, strangled, or whatever, other people who are bystanders are shaken by it. Even when Tommy, when he comes back and kills Billy Batts, Tommy is shaken by it, and they all kind of are. Like, if you watch when Robert De Niro is shooting Billy Batts in the trunk in the opening scene, Ray Liotta is flinching and like just recoiling from it. Right, that these horrible acts of violence, even to the people who are in the life, are still upsetting and still shake you up, which is goes to the you know, the thing. I mean, I guess The Godfather does as well with Michael shooting the policeman and flipping out about it in the, you know, in the restaurant or whatever. But right. This movie never backs away from the idea that the thing that is normalized is pretending it is normal. But the violence is never, you know, there is no way not to react to the violence. They're not all so hardened that it doesn't bother them. It still does.
Right. Toward the end of the movie, we get, so Henry does his first time. Because so Polly, who is the boss here, and that is Paul Cicero. It's played by Paul Sorvino. Great part here as well. Another great performance, I would say. And he is, you know, he's understated. He's introduced as the guy who doesn't have a phone in his house and won't talk to anybody on the phone, and he won't talk to more than one person at a time. So everything is relayed, which is like his method of not being caught, I guess, or tracked down. So. He says you gotta go back. You gotta go home to the family after the horror and 2R incident. But he says, but first go down to Tampa. There's a guy down there, but then you'll have a nice weekend. And they take him to the zoo and they're gonna feed him to the lions. And he says, oh no, I'll pay you. And he's like, God, the narration is like, I guess they really feed people to the lions down there in Tampa.
Upside down camera shot of the lion.
Yeah, because as soon as we did that, he said he would pay us, but. The guy's sister worked as a typist for the FBI, and she gave us everybody, and so he gets sent away, and he gets sent away, and Paul Cicero gets sent away, which leads to another one of my favorite scenes in the movie. First off, the indelible scene of them shaving the garlic with a razor blade,
which is pointless.
But it's like, oh, and it just melts in the pan. But I love that. And of course, the idea here is that they are in prison, they are in the ultimate Epicurean salon, right? It's like they're bringing in lobsters. They lived alone in their little area.
And
we own the joint.
They're still having
the
typical arguments that would be played up even more of The Sopranos. Oh, I thought he'd use too many onions. Like the bickering is still the friendly family bickering over the quality of the
Three
food.
Onions?
Still there.
Three onions.
And don't use too many onions.
And of course, right after we get told how luxurious they have it, we see that when Karen comes to visit Henry, it's in the same just zoo everyone else is in.
Right, right. But they're off in their own little special thing.
She's unpacking all like the bread and the cold cuts right out of her coat when she's getting mad at him, but with the guard intentionally looking the other way.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So we get all of that, and they do their time, and it's just this thing like that. But this is also where Henry starts to take the pills. Like his falling apart is speeding up here. And then after that scene, and the Lufthansa heist and all that happens. And so all that's going on, and then they kill all the people to the Layla piano exit. But we get that moment where, the death of Billy Batts comes back around, which is, they're going to make it's the happy occasion. Happiest occasion for any gangster is when one of their friends is going to be a made man, and they explain like, made man, they can't kill you unless you get permission, and all this stuff has got to go on, and it's got to be. And we know that Billy Batts was a made man, which is why that this is a problem. But it's receded enough into the background that we get the moment where it's like, Jimmy, because he's Tommy, because he's a full-blooded, is going to be a made man. And it's like, everybody's so happy for him. And they take him, and there's that amazing scene where they lead him into the house, and they're like going to take him into the room, and there's nobody in the room. And he says, and then he can't say even no. They shoot him in the back of the head. And then he gets the call from is that Martin Scorsese's dad?
Yes, it's Charles Scorsese.
Right, and it's that moment. Yeah.
Well, there's nothing we could do.
Because yeah, we had a problem.
It's because it's him and Tutti who are the two, and Tutti is the one who shoots him. And that's Frank DeLeo, the record producer, who also you may know from Wayne's World as the record producer, who Mr. Big, who comes and gives them the record or the big contract at the end, or Wayne's girlfriend, the big contract at the end of Wayne's World. He was in very few movies, but also produced a bazillion albums.
It is the most cold-blooded thing in the movie that they have Tutti pull the trigger.
Right. And it's Paul Cicero's like little brother.
Yeah,
who's a minor functionary, but it's him and Marty Scorsese's dad in that room, and he pulls the trigger, bullet, you know, right out the front of Joe Pesci's head, and then
Marty so they couldn't give him an open casket.
Yeah, and then they do the thing that I also love from the Studio Ghibli movie, the opening of Castle in the Sky. They do that, then there's some voiceover. They go back to him on the phone booth saying there's nothing we could do, we had a problem, blah blah blah. Then they cut back to Joe Pesci just so we can see the blood. Slowly drain. Raining out of his head and covering the floor.
Yeah. And so Charles Scorsese can say, and that's that.
That phone call to De Niro is amazing, right? Like, it's like, we just could, nothing could be
this
done.
This is what we've lost with gone. Cell phones.
What do you
hitting,
mean?
Hitting the phone against the side of the receiver. People
the
who
handset
never lived
onto the payphone? Yeah.
Yeah. The payphone era. People who don't know how sturdy those payphone handles were and how it's just such a visceral act that is... Now it can only be seen in
period. I did not know you could just push a phone booth over like that.
Well, yeah. Why would you want to?
You can with your Robert De Niro.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess I'll try that then.
Next time you've got murder rage, the next time one of us is whacked, Monty, you can get angry and toss over a phone booth.
I just like all the euphemisms, right? It's like, oh, he's gone. Nothing we could do.
We lost him.
He's gone. Yeah, we lost
there
him.
There was a problem.
There was a problem, you know, with Billy Batts and, you know, and it's like, and then we get the, emotion from Robert De Niro. He's very upset about it. And Henry's there and they're both very upset. But it's funny because you'd think, oh, well, at least with Tommy out of the picture, things will be less insane in the life of Henry Hill. That is not what happens.
No.
Because you see, he's been getting the cocaine money from Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And so it is very after everybody has been taken care of and he's been getting the cocaine money. We get the May 11th, 1980 sequence. So this is the descent into madness.
This is part of the management lesson of this movie, right? Why was Ray Liotta having to do it? Well, one was when he was inside, as Paulie says, whatever you had to do when you were inside, that's fine. You have to make money when you're in prison. We understand that. You got to do drugs. When you're out here, don't do that. But the reason Henry is pursuing this is because he's hit the ceiling of his ability to progress within the organization because he's not full-blooded.
Yeah.
So if he wants to progress and gain more wealth and power, he has to do it on his own. And that's why he's going through Pittsburgh connections to do all the drug deal stuff. So really, Paulie could have prevented this if he said, you know what? I'm opening the books. I'm allowing people who are not pure-blooded Italian to rise of my organization, and then Henry could have stuck with Paulie and in the romanticized world of gangsters and Hollywood movies not been a drug dealer.
Yeah, and this is the line that makes me laugh every time in the narration is, this is the bad time. And it's like he's desperate. He goes back to Karen after he gets out on bail and he's like, well, I need to sell that cocaine you were hiding. And she's like, well, I flushed it down the toilet because it was an FBI raid. And he's like, they wouldn't have found it, Karen. It's like, based on what evidence?
They were looking everywhere. And he's totally wrong about that.
The first rule of an FBI raid is you flush the cocaine down the toilet. Everyone knows
this. First rule. Yeah. But he's like, but he is not thinking logically and is desperate and remembers that there was cocaine there. But he's like, why'd you do it, Karen? It's like, because they would have found it. But he doesn't take that. And of course, Paulie is furious. So because he said, you can't do this. You can't do the drugs. I need you out of that. Which you're right. It's a little bit like, I'm not going to rise you anymore or pay you anymore. But you
also don't want you doing anything on your own.
Yeah, you've got a non-compete here with the mob. You can't do drugs.
We can frame it as a moral stand if we want, but basically it's Paulie doesn't want to go to jail because one of his guys talked to a drug dealer.
The laws around drugs are so draconian that very minor offenses you get huge amounts of time. It's much better to stick with intimidation insurance for
what Paulie thought was going to happen happens.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. So he gives him $3,000
And for a lifetime.
For a lifetime. Yeah, exactly right. And then Karen meets with Jimmy, and we get that scene just right down there. And there's that line, nobody tells you they're going to kill you. They come with smiles. They come as your friends. So I met Jimmy in a crowded place. We both knew. And Jimmy's trying to find out if he's going to rat him out. And he says, I want you to go down to Florida and do a hit. And again, we get that. That's when I knew line, right? We're just like with Maury. By the way, mentioning Maury, I just want to say, I love the Maury's wigs don't come off ad. and then I love that he's immediately strangled and the wig comes off his head.
Mm-hmm. And they both start laughing about it coming off.
The commercial is clearly fake, right? He jumps into the water, then you cut to him standing in the water and the wig is completely dry.
Yeah, it's a bad commercial. Yeah, exactly.
So, like Monty, I've read the book, and apparently the person whom De Niro's character is based on was an insomniac, and he would sit up late at night, and these commercials would air, and he'd be all, this guy owes me money, and I'm watching these stupid commercials, and he was driven mad with rage, because this is a thing that really happened. There was a toupee salesman who was big into Jimmy, and needed to be taught a lesson.
Yeah, this is another thing in this movie, it helps you to sympathize with these people, right? So Maury is annoying, and he's so doesn't get the point that don't nag the mobsters that you owe money to, right? Like he just doesn't get it, no matter how many times Henry explains it, and it's like
Jimmy is being an unconscionable ballbuster.
Yeah, the audience turns on Maury so quickly but then Maury's wife shows up, he hasn't called, he's never been out all night without calling.
Once. Not once.
And they're like,
Morris,
oh, I'm sure.
And
she goes to Henry, yeah, who had previously thought that he was going to be fine. But as soon as Maury's wife shows up, Henry knows that now Maury's been whacked. But what he has to actually say to her is, I'm sure he's fine. He's just sleeping it off somewhere. And the camera's swirling around her and her hair is all disheveled. And then you feel for Maury again. How does the movie do it?
Maury's wigs. Don't come off. It's so good. It's up there with the Ghostbusters ad as my filmmakers making hilarious TV ads. I love it. TV ads inside movies.
With the amazing graphics with like the text over the black background, those graphics that he paid for. You know, Jimmy's got money to pay for those commercials, but not to pay me.
Yeah. Well, and Maury's so needy too, right? He's like, I gotta see Jimmy. I need my money. Why do you need your money? He never explains that.
I mean, he's a gambling addict. That's why he needs money. But the other thing is that at a certain point the audience realize Jimmy's never given anyone any money, right?
No.
and then like at first, like Maury's, you gotta chill out, Maury, he'll get your money, but then we're like, no, Maury, you're never gonna get your money.
If
it's
Maury
so clear
had any
now.
Sense, he would like offered some sort of deal. Like he owed Jimmy money at first, so maybe you could just take some off that or
yeah.
Give me a credit line at Gap,
what,
something.
What am I, a schmuck on wheels?
the end of this movie, Henry Hill gives evidence against all of his former associates.
To a real FBI agent, right?
Yeah.
The real U.S. attorney who handled his case.
So he...
And boy, does it show in his performance.
There's also that great moment of like witness protection where like, oh, I don't want to go.
Just whoever controls it, just no place. Like the idea, again, the idea that like the used to the privileged life of being a mobster, it's like, I don't need to know the details. Just make it happen for me.
And Karen is not on board, right? Karen is like, well, you know, do I...
need him. You don't need me.
Frankly, I don't care whether you come or not, other than that if it makes him happy.
You're going to die if you don't.
You're going to die. And I think the true story is that she went with him and then divorced him, right? Like, so.
Yes. I believe they sent him to Washington State. Kind of cold there.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is Henry Hill's recidivism rate was rather high.
Sure. Yes, of course.
They have them the text at the end
continued to be a drug dealer. And
Karen did not stay with him.
Yeah. And he was so awful that they actually kicked him out of the program.
Yeah.
So you are on your own now, buddy.
I am fascinated with this fact. Nick Pileggi, who wrote Wise Guys, is married to Nora Ephron.
Oh, yes.
Nora Ephron wrote the script for the movie My Blue Heaven,
which is based on
Wise Guys.
Wise Guys.
It came out a month before Goodfellas, but it's basically a sequel to Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Wild stuff. So the end of this movie, in the movie, they arrest everybody. He has,
it's like
there's
a
very,
in China, that's why, right?
There's a very poetic line about how all that I have is my birth certificate and my arrest sheet. That's all you'd ever know that I was
never
alive.
Voted, never paid taxes.
But it's like he's just completely disloyal. He sets them all up. And this is the moment where the movie at the very end really wants, he's talking to us directly in the camera, as we said earlier. And he says the hardest thing ever for was leaving the life. He's like, he really wants you to empathize with him. But like in the end, he's like, but listen, I'm the real victim here.
Yeah.
I'm in the suburbs in a comfortable place where I wear a robe and get my newspaper on my front step. But there's no action.
Fate worse than death.
I have to wait in lines with regular people. I'm a schnook. Oh, you poor guy. The end.
And this is the thing that comes across in like the Scorsese interviews when he's talking about the character. He says, oh, that poor guy, he doesn't get to do things anymore. Oh, he's sad that he can't commit crimes.
But the movie actually ends on, they do a fast cut to Joe Pesci pointing at the camera with a mobster hat on it, shooting into the thing with like, and especially in the movie theater when the volume's up real loud, it's almost a jump scare, one last jump scare to smack the audience in the face and to remind them that thing that he's romanticizing, that was the thing with Tommy killing people. It wasn't as great as he thought it was.
And that's here's Martin Scorsese, the film school student. It's a callback to this really famous shot of the cowboy who points the gun at in early cinema days and
the great train robbery.
There, thank you.
That's
thank
what
you,
the
Monty.
Other half of Scorsese's introduction was about. It was all about we improvised that scene, and this is from the great train robbery.
Yeah. And he's that's why he's got a hat on that he never wears at any other point in the movie.
Exactly. No, it's a great train robbery shout out.
And then they do have the text on the screen that explains that he doesn't exactly live happily after. They do get divorced.
There is
he
no happily ever after for anyone in this movie.
The updated version for people who are curious is Paul Cicero. They say basically died in prison.
And he said he didn't want to do.
They
like
say
they
Jimmy.
Had the scene before.
Jimmy is in prison. Well, Jimmy also died in prison.
Yeah.
And as for Henry, you see, they made a book and a movie about his life, and he pretty much ate out on that for the rest of his life while being arrested at various times and you know, reconciling with his kids sometimes and not other times, and basically
and
being just
most
the
importantly,
same guy.
not being killed by the mob.
And not never killed, died of cancer in his late 70s in
LA. I can tell
LA.
You that. He may have reconciled at some point with his kids. His kids do not care for him.
No, like on, I said, he reconciled and then didn't. And then like it was a whole ugly thing. Yeah.
Yeah. They
exactly
they
right.
Didn't, but they don't much.
I think that comes across in the movie when the only time we ever see the kids is when he's like screaming at his wife and storming out of the house. And they show that these terrified children. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Not father
was,
of the year.
I guess he was 69 when he died. But yeah.
Yeah.
So, that was, and he had, you know, had a girlfriend and was like, again, living large on being Henry Hill, the famous mobster. And they did never whack him because, you know, I guess he was too high profile.
No, because all the people who were
and
wanted
were
to
in
whack
jail.
Him were dead.
They're
all dead.
Dead or in
dead.
Jail.
Yeah,
that's true.
Here's another one for our management book, Outlive Your Enemies.
Oh, yeah, I love
no
it.
No one will
yeah.
try and kill you.
Well, Jimmy was trying to make that happen faster than normal. He didn't outlive his enemies.
Paul
just Cicero, killed them all.
Once Paul Cicero goes to jail, somebody else swoops in and takes this territory over.
Exactly.
And they're okay with the situation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
Well, that's Goodfellas. It is, like I said, one of my favorites. And what I love about it is that it's got these great characters, great scenes, the great music. It's got good writing. It has something to say that is sort of a nice kind of counterpoint to the most legendary film in the genre up to that point of gangster movies, The Godfather, to take a different tack on it and making it less glamorous and showing the foot soldiers and showing what that life is. And I don't know. And it is Martin Scorsese at the maybe height of his powers.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it is. It's remarkable. What have we not covered that you guys would like to talk about?
I have a technical question that I don't think I probably looked this up on the internet so long ago I've already forgotten. The babysitter has got a plane ticket. He holds the plane ticket. They put the black box over it. Is that because they couldn't get paid by the airline and they didn't have computers to blank it out?
I can help with this. Yes. They absolutely. It was absolutely. They American Airlines would not give clearance to show their logo, and I think it was one of those things where Scorsese said, "Well, it kind of looks like a documentary anyhow, so this adds to that." And just sort of shrugged and said, "It's not how I was planning to do it, but let's make lemonade out of lemons." Here.
It's a good thing to show your children. Say, see, the days before CGI, this is what they had to do. If they found themselves in a situation where they had that footage and they couldn't get clearance from American Airlines, the black box was the only option.
That's all we could do. No.
You'll have to also explain what physical plane tickets were.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And it's, you could steal them and sell them for money.
And you could pack your baby bag with cocaine and no one would find it.
That's right. Just put it on your pants and in your baby bag and you'll be fine.
I guess one of the things that I would like to throw out there, Goodfellas is one of my two favorite movies ever. Basically, my favorite movie depends on what mood I'm in. The other one is Miller's Crossing, which came out 3 days after Goodfellas.
Wow.
And it was a good year for you.
And is also a gangster movie. And I look at that sometimes and think, I need to develop wider interests.
Yeah, a gangster movie featuring headshots, Phil.
Well, the Miller's Crossing is when he's feeling down. And okay, this is the movie when you're feeling up.
Oh, no, Miller's Crossing is great. Miller's Crossing makes me feel very happy. No, that's the happy movie. Goodfellas is...
John Polito in Miller's Crossing is giving the advice that they use on Joe Pesci in Goodfellas, which is you got to shoot him in the head.
Yeah. Always put one in the brain.
You got to shoot him in the head. That's the
lesson. Look into your heart.
And in fact, at one point, I think I proposed to Jason... an old movie club that was going to be Goodfellas and Miller's Crossing. And Jason saw, first off, they were released in the 90s. Those aren't old movies. Oh, wait, they are. Oh, God, we're all going to die.
Yep,
our bones are dust.
Uh-huh. And second, that's a lot of darkness for one podcast episode. But I also do like Miller's Crossing. It's a good movie.
Yeah, it's a really good movie.
I had two things. One, I want to shout out young Henry. I think he's very good in this movie.
Yes.
He is.
And
good
there
casting,
is a
good look.
His last shot, it is so carefully shot and framed. It is the angle at which he looks the most like Ray Liotta. It's I found myself appreciating it this time. It's like he doesn't always look like Ray Liotta, but sometimes he really does look like Ray Liotta. And that last shot of him is just enough to get you through to the other side to Ray Liotta.
And the other thing is a great no line performance. The cop who tastes the cocaine.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Well, the horrible in real life, Bo Deedle is saying terrible things to Henry Hill. Yes, that guy is great.
Yeah.
Yeah, the nodding, right? Smiling and nodding. And
yeah, he picks, taps his finger on it, taps it on the tongue, and then just
you're going to bake a
smile.
Cake? Oh, what do we got there? Oh, goodbye, dickhead.
That's actually a nice little tidbit, too, because when Henry is over at Debbie Mazur's house, he like looks at the bowl and the table and he's like, this is a mess, you got to clean this up, there's cocaine everywhere. And like, again, I think it shows in our management tips for gangsters why Henry is not a great manager. Mm-hmm. Because not only is that a mess, of course, the babysitter, he explicitly tells her not to call, and obviously she doesn't respect his authority and management mm-hmm. style either, because she just literally hangs up and then picks the phone back up and calls. When he says, you got to call from somewhere else, they've tapped the line, helicopters mm-hmm. are following me, and she's like, I don't really want to go anywhere else, I'm just going to pick up the phone. And that comes back to bite him, as does the lack of like using the dishwasher at Debbie Mazur's place to get
the dishwasher,
all the cocaine off of everything that has cocaine
then she throws a bag of cocaine at the door as he leaves and it just poof
yeah, I know,
pile of powder. It's
that's
like
evidence,
the whole place
baby.
Is coated with it.
Evidence.
Another good casting choice is the and I think there's no lines as well, is the terrifying shark-faced mob lawyer that smiles at the judge. The judge looks up to see the kid Henry next to his lawyer, then they show the lawyer, and the lawyer just smiles, and the judge is like, ugh. Mob
yeah.
wise.
Yeah.
If anyone ever, like, the casting for that was, I need someone who looks like a mob lawyer, and it's like, this is the guy. Mob lawyer.
Yeah, he may actually be a mob lawyer. Who knows?
I also have that CBS special. Hey, if you want to learn more about this, visit your local library. Made Men, The Story of Goodfellas by Glenn Kenny is a great book to read if you really want to dive into almost a shot-by-shot analysis of this movie. And Monty mentioned the point shaving scandal, which is not covered at all in the movie. ESPN did a documentary on it a few years back, and it's floating around out there, and it's really good to watch.
I was going to mention my one kind of like 6 degrees away from Goodfellas is my journalism school professor, Vince Cosgrove, who worked at the New York Daily News, who passed away a couple of years ago. Vince knew Nick Pileggi, and Nick Pileggi said basically, I got another one of these guys, and I already wrote this Henry Hill book. I'm not going to write another one, but maybe you could write a book with this guy. And it led to a book called Tin for Sale. The subtitle is A Crooked Cop's Journey from the NYPD to the Mob. And I always thought, like, how did Nick Pileggi know all these guys? But this was obviously like a spinoff where it was like, oh, I didn't even get to the dirty cops part. And then he gave my professor Vince, he gave Vince that story. He was like, yeah, write that. Write that
Jason,
story.
It's covered in the Glenn Kenny book.
Is it?
Yeah. That basically Nick Pileggi was a crime reporter at one point.
Yeah.
And
he knew all these guys.
And was
he wrote the book that Casino was based on, too.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and apparently he didn't want to. My guess is that he didn't want to deal with this dirty cop. He was like, "Look, life's too short for me to deal with all these."
Plenty
guys.
Of dirty cops in Goodfellas too. I think every cop you see is just taking money from the mob.
And
except for the one guy who pinches Henry, and Henry's like, "Oh, it's okay," and it's like somehow he got the one good cop to pick him
yeah.
up.
Yeah, well, you know, bad luck. It happens sometimes. Anyway, I just find it funny that was the one where Nick Pileggi is like, "I don't want to write this book." Vince, you want to write a book? I know you. You work at the Daily News. You know these guys. Like you write the book about the dirty cop, and Vince is like, all right, I'm not Nick Pileggi, but you give me a story, I'll write about it. And so we did. I just always thought that was really funny. Like Nick Pileggi's like, hey, I don't want to deal with this. I don't want to write about this guy.
It's
you
like,
know,
what's his name from The Wire? Like, how did he know all the things that he knew to write The Wire?
Oh, yeah, sure, David Simon, because he worked at the Baltimore Sun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, it was fun to revisit this movie and also to talk about it. It is legitimately a great movie. If you are still listening to this and not seen this movie, I mean, first off, what are you doing? And second, go see this movie. Everything you've heard about how great it is on this podcast and also in the world up to now, from 1990 to now, is true. It's
and nothing about it, probably even including the black box, ages badly or anything. Good movie making is good movie making forever.
No,
there
the
is
style.
Nothing in this that will take you out of it because it's you know
the style and the voice and the technique, and like it is so good, and it is not fussy and old school. That's sort of what I was saying too about the Martin Scorsese, and you think, oh well, you know, it's like Homework. He's a classic filmmaker, and it's gonna make me listen to opera and all of those things. It's like no. I know he's an old man now, but you know,
at one point he was doing things that nobody else.
He was
do.
A wild, maybe angry, maybe just a little dyspeptic, but young man. And like, and then by 1990, when he was like, okay, I'm going to make this gangster movie, and it's just spectacular and funny and weird and violent, but in a way that does not romanticize the violence, which is, I want to say, I feel like is one of the reasons that I love it so much, is that when the violence happens, you could watch this movie, I guess, if you're a person who watches the violence happen and think, oh, that's so cool. But like the movie's not on your side if you think that.
It wants to jar you out of that feeling, and it will do everything that it can to make the violence upsetting and visceral in ways like it boggles my mind that anybody can watch this and be cheering it on, because it always, even if it's just the squelching sounds when Tommy's shoving the knife into Billy Bat, like it does not want you to be feeling good about this ever.
But no. I do laugh when you say the squelching noises, you know? Like, I do enjoy it.
Well, there is the comic aspect of, I mean, even if, like when he shoots Spider, this terrifying scene, Joe Pesci is still funny and charming. He's what? You think this is the first hole I ever dug? I'll dig the hole, whatever.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I mean, when Tommy says, man, I'm a good shot. What?
I love that line.
That's the worst part about this movie, is that it will make you laugh at the worst moments.
That is actually a brilliant scene, because it's like Tommy never wants to lose face. He is just obsessed with not being embarrassed and not losing face. And you just killed a guy because he said something to you, and you just killed him. And now it's a problem, and we're going to have to. And Robert De Niro's response, of course, is basically like, oh, I'm not digging the hole.
You're digging the hole.
But he wants to paper it over. So he's got his quick, he's got his quick quips. Right? Because he just wants to move it on and not be judged for this, the fact that he just murdered this kid. Wow. All right. Let me thank my guests for being here. This was excellent. Monty Ashley, thank you.
Medium rare. An aristocrat.
John Syracuse, thank you.
Never rat on your friends. Always keep your mouth shut.
And Philip Michaels, thank you.
You know, it's good and all, but it's no Dances with Wolves.
Oh, no.
Too soon. Ending on a good note.
All right, well, now, and as for me, I'm your host. I'm just an average nobody, a schnook. It's me, Jason Snell, and I thank you for listening to this episode of The Incomparable. We will see you next time.